Good evening and welcome to Warwick. It's wonderful to see so many of you here. No status anxieties for Alain de Botton. I'm Angie Hobbs and I lecture in the Warwick Philosophy Department on Ancient Philosophy and Ethics. And it's a real pleasure to welcome Alain de Botton here this evening, who of course will be well known to many of you from all his books and radio and television programs and articles. His books, of course, include Essays in Love, How Proust Can Change Your Life, I really recommend that, The Consolations of Philosophy and the Art of Travel, as well, of course, as tonight's Status Anxiety. Now, of the very many ways in which Alain de Botton, in the language of 1066 and all that, is a good thing, I have highlighted just three good things to mention now. And interestingly, they all show the ways in which Alain is returning philosophy very helpfully to its ancient Greek roots, in my opinion. Firstly, Socrates says that the key ethical questions are how one should live and what sort of person one should be. And Alain, I believe, continues this very honourable Socratic tradition of showing us how the study of philosophy and literature isn't just an academic exercise, but can really help us explore how to live our lives and how to live our lives more fruitfully and happily. Secondly, Alain also follows Socrates in his belief that philosophy shouldn't be an esoteric academic exercise undertaken by an elite few closeted away in some library. It should be taken out into the modern equivalent of the Athenian marketplaces and gymnasia. Philosophers should seek to communicate with as many people as possible from as many diverse occupations as possible. And again in the traditions of ancient Greece, Alain, I believe, tries to break down the unhelpful barriers that have arisen between philosophy and literature, though not at Warwick because we have a degree in it. And he tries to show us that the task of both philosophers and artists is to try to explore, to understand, and if possible, try to ameliorate the human condition. And to that end, he turns to very many psychologists, economists, writers, artists, and philosophers in his work. Now, in all these ways, I believe that Alain de Botton is doing something very important and very necessary, and it's a real pleasure to introduce him to talk about status anxiety tonight. Thank you.
Thank you all very much, and thank you for that wonderful and too kind introduction. I'm going to be talking tonight about my new book, which is called Status Anxiety. And I should perhaps start by trying to define this term that I call status anxiety. And I think the feeling of status anxiety is the sort of thing you might feel at moments of everyday life when, for example, you're trying to get through to someone, you put in a call to them and they never call you back, or when you hear about a party that you might have been invited to but haven't been, or when a friend of yours or a colleague has been promoted. It's the sort of feeling that I think Gore Vidal was talking about in his famous quip when he said that every time a friend of mine succeeds, a small part of me dies. And I think it's that sort of area, a very uncomfortable area, of course, because I think one of the features of status anxiety is that it's quite embarrassing to admit. You know, when a good friend of yours says that they've been promoted, it's quite hard to go, actually, I'm not that happy for you. Your success has made me feel inadequate. I wish you would fail. In a way, I wish you would get sacked. It's just very, very hard to admit to. But all of this goes on in ourselves. And one of my aims for the book is really to kickstart a discussion about this, because many problems have no solutions, but at least by understanding them, by starting a conversation about them, we can alleviate at least some of their sort of side effects. I myself first started feeling status anxiety when I first left university, and suddenly what started to matter was not, you know, what you were like, but what you did. George Orwell said in one of his essays that after 20, no one cares whether you're nice or not. And I think there is some truth to that, that suddenly what matters when two people meet is, you know, the answer to the question, what do you do? And if you have an impressive answer to that, then people will suddenly start to be quite nice to you. And if you haven't, they'll be a bit less nice and head for the door as soon as they can. So this is a new sort of painful feature of life, I think, that everyone has to go through as they enter sort of adult life. I think all societies are shaped as hierarchies, and so all societies have status anxieties, though of course there are many different kinds of things that you get status for in different societies, and we'll go on to talk about that. My book is divided really into two sections, looking firstly at the causes of status anxiety and then advancing some possible solutions to the problem. I think the origins of status anxiety, the whole problem really starts with childhood. And the thing is that every child, all of us, as babies, had extremely high status. Our parents tended to be absolutely delighted whatever we did. If you look at the way that people behave towards babies, they pull a little smile and everyone's absolutely delighted and it all seems very nice. You don't have to do very much to seem very, very special as a baby. But as you grow up, a new and more troubling thing starts to happen. It's no longer just enough to sort of wave your doll around and pull a nice smile. That's not going to impress anyone at 18. Whereas it was, you know, good enough at age 2 or 3. So it's a terribly painful way in which we start to become a lot less special. But we've all known what it's like to be very, very special. That's the position of a baby in childhood. And then that decreases. And I think a lot of what we do is a search to recapture at least some of the pleasure of getting that much love, or you could call it respect or dignity, that sense of being valued by other people. And I think that desire to be valued and respected explains a lot of what we do in adult life. I think to a large extent it explains why we work. Economists have been rather sort of blunt about in explaining why people work. They tell us that people work for money, which is, of course, partly true, but I think people also work, to a large extent, for status. And the whole issue of money and status are quite closely connected, and yet, nevertheless, I think there is a distinction to be drawn. A lot of what makes a lot of low-paid work unpleasant isn't so much just the low pay, it's the lack of respect and dignity that comes with those jobs. Just as a lot of what makes highly paid work interesting isn't just the pay that you're going to get, but also the dignity and respect that tends to come from the process of material accumulation. So behind a lot of our so-called sort of rational economic urges lies this sort of search for status and an attempt to recapture some of that feeling that we had as we waved our toys around at a young age. I think a key reason why we feel status anxiety is because of the existence of a large number of people that in my book I call snobs. And the thing about snobs is that as soon as you come into their orbit, they'll tend to say something like, what do you do? And depending on your answer, they'll either treat you nicely or not so nicely. There have been lots of attempts to define the word snob. And often we associate the word snob with someone who's very hung up on whether you should call the lavatory a loo or a toilet or a lavatory, or you know, what fork you should use at dinner. I think that's a very sort of old-fashioned and perhaps redundant view of snob. Because I think at the heart of snobbery is just a method of discriminating according to some one criterion of discrimination. So, you know, you could have a music snob who will talk to you if you like certain kinds of music and will think nothing of you if you don't. But then sort of more broadly, there is a kind of snobbery that centres around our common value system in society, which is based, I think, on careers. And the sort of the career snob is the person who's going to be asking you, you know, what you do and responding in one way or another in relation to your answer. If the snob is at one end of the spectrum of how people behave to us, at the other end of the spectrum is your mother. And the good thing about your mother, one's mother, an ideal mother, is that she doesn't really mind how well you're doing. She's not going to stop talking to you if you're sacked, or be very nice, you know, that much nicer to you. This is ideally, you know, if you're doing well. There are some people who have snobbish mothers, and that's a problem which we can discuss. But essentially, I think some of the reason why we mind, or a lot of the reason why we mind about our status, why we care about our status, is because of the existence of a wide constituency of snobs. That also explains, I think, our interest in status symbols. And, you know, we tend to imagine status symbols as just being, you know, a fast car or a big house. And these are, I think, key status symbols in our society. But status symbols can come in all shapes and sizes. I mean, a volume of poetry left on your desk can act as a status symbol, as can a very old car and very sort of threadbare clothes. It really depends who your audience is. But I think, really, a status symbol is just any material object which you use in order to try and get respect, to try and sort of get dignity out of other people. So I think there's a sort of emotional poignancy to the way that people use status symbols. We might mock people who've got gold taps all over their house, or who've got, you know, particularly brash sports cars or whatever. But I think behind anyone who's got a Ferrari, you'll find someone not just who wants to go fast from A to B, but perhaps much more importantly, someone who wants to be treated nicely, someone who wants to be treated with respect. And it so happens that in our society, you do tend often to get treated slightly in a slightly nicer way if you have got a nice car. So, as it were, the use of status symbols is something that the audience is responsible for, as much as the people who retracted to actually purchasing these symbols. I was talking to a psychologist the other day, and he told me that probably only about 10% of the population of Britain is emotionally healthy. He also added that we never hear of these people, you know, they don't come to Warwick and give a talk or write books or anything like that. The reason is because they are not trying to make up for some sort of original sense of inadequacy. And I think there is a way in which, behind the use of status symbols, behind the search for visible success, etc., there does always tend to lie the opposite, a sense of precisely being invisible, of inadequacy, etc. So, as I say, I think there's an emotionally poignant side to people's appetite for luxury goods. I think there are some universal features of status anxiety, universal causes, but I think there are also some causes that one could pin down much more specifically to certain features of modern society, to the way that we live nowadays. And one of these particularly modern ideas that has contributed a lot to our anxiety about our status is the notion that we can ourselves transform our status, that there should be no ceiling to our expectations, that wherever we've come from, whatever our background, we should be able to achieve anything. And that's very much something, an idea that started in America with the American Revolution of 1776 and the birth of a society which very strongly believed that people's status should not be handed to them on a plate through their parents, through their bloodlines, through their origins, but that status of each generation should be founded on the achievements of that generation. And to a large extent, this has come true in the United States and many Western countries, ours included. There is, you know, very much a way in which we are no longer caste-like societies where you stay absolutely in your place. There is great movement, and there is great hope of movement. And there is a lot of language, there's a lot of talk about the hope of movement. If you go into an American self-help bookshop, the shelves are full, and indeed in Britain too, the shelves are full of books that tell you how you can transform your status, how you can become someone perhaps other than you currently are. When I was writing this book, I came across a particular example of this, an American self-help writer called Anthony Robbins, who's one of America's most famous self-help writers. And he wrote a book called Awaken the Giant Within. And the theme of this book is really all of us are day-to-day often quite small, but we have a giant, metaphoric giant within us. And the goal of Anthony Robbins is to show us a power, there's a capital P in his book, that can help to release this giant and make us successful. The subtitle of the book is How to Take Immediate Control of Your Mental, Emotional, Physical, and Financial Destiny. Let me read you a little bit from Anthony Robbins, where he talks about his own transformation and his own discovery of his power that has made him a giant. He says, "I used my power to take back control of my physical well-being, and I permanently rid myself of 38 pounds of fat. Through it, I attracted the woman of my dreams, I married her, and I created the family I desired. I used my power to change my income from subsistence level to over $20 million a year. This moved me from my tiny apartment, where I was washing my dishes in the bathtub because there was no kitchen, to my family's current home, the Del Mar Castle, worth $60 million. So that's Anthony Robbins and his view. It may be slightly extreme. I think it is slightly extreme, but I think it's characteristic of an attitude that one finds all over the Western world. Really this idea that there should be no limit to your expectations, that you can become anything. And not just become anything, but also buy anything. There's been accompanying this revolution in your status expectations, there's also been a revolution in consumer expectations. The idea is now that anything that we can see around us should be made available at a relatively cheap price, that there should be nothing reserved simply for an elite. And this is, again, something that United States has sort of led the way on, the idea that everyone should have a house, a car, a television, etc. When Franklin Roosevelt was once asked which book best summarized or captured the spirit of the United States, he had a little think and then came up with a rather facetious answer that the work of American literature that best told you about America was the Sears catalog. It's the equivalent of, you know, the Argos catalog or something. It's filled with things that at one point would have been the preserve of an elite, which are now made widely available to all. The downside of all this, in a word, is envy. I think in a society in which you are told that we are all equal and that anyone could have anything if only they work hard for it, you're also going to have a huge problem with envy. And I think the thing about envy is that we don't tend to envy everybody. We only tend to envy people who we can in some way identify with, who in some way we feel equal to. If you think of the people that you envy, they're not people who are perhaps very far away from you, who are a different gender to you, a different age group to you. They tend to be people, to speak personally, the people I'm envious of are not writers, female writers in their 50s in Australia. They are male writers in their 30s in Britain. I won't name names. But essentially, anything that brings people together, anything that bridges the gap makes people feel envious, which is why, you know, it's highly unlikely that anyone here would feel envious of the Queen, but it's much more likely that people here will feel envious of maybe someone they were at school with, at university with, someone who has much less than the Queen in relation to them, but nevertheless, because of the proximity, is much more of a threat, is much more of a source of envy. So in a society in which people are constantly told that everyone is equal, and yet in which there's an awful lot of inequality still around, you will be hugely raising the danger of envy. And not only this, you will also be cancelling out the benefits of any general increase in wealth. It's been one of the great paradoxes of the last sort of quarter century or so, when societies in the West have grown hugely wealthy compared to what they were a few generations ago. There's been an enormous rise in living standards. And yet, as many, many commentators have pointed out, there's a curious way in which people don't feel that much wealthier. They don't feel that much better off. And this is a real paradox. Mind you, it's only a paradox if you don't look closely enough at the way in which people start to feel fortunate or unfortunate. No one compares themselves, it would be very unusual at least, to compare ourselves and feel fortunate in relation to the lives of our great-great-grandparents or to the lives of people in sub-Saharan Africa. We only tend to feel fortunate when we have as much as, or preferably just that little bit more than, the people we were at school with, at university with, our neighbours, our social circle, our reference group. These are the people who will determine our priorities. And of course, the problem is that as you know, we may be becoming richer and we may be increasing our status, but so is everyone else. So any gains tend to get cancelled out. And this is the real sort of sticking point. A wise philosopher who observed this right at its infancy was the French 18th century philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was observing the birth of the modern world and came to the view that really from his work, anyway, we can deduce the idea. He gives us sort of handy tips on how to become rich. And I think from Rousseau's work, we get the idea that in order to become rich, the last thing you should try and do is to try and make more money. The problem with making more money is that you'll then start to meet other people with more money, and you won't feel so rich anymore. So any gains will cancel themselves out. So I think one of the lessons we can find from Rousseau is that the best way to get rich is to ditch any friend of yours who's happens to have done better than you have. These people, obviously, a great source of inadequacy, and they should quickly be gotten rid of. And one should surround oneself with people who are much, much less successful than oneself. It's only among these people that one will feel really comfortable. So that's one suggestion. But generally, I mean, I think that, you know, Rousseau was onto something about the idea of that a sense of well-being is all relative. It's all dependent on the community. I think one of the side effects of these hugely increased expectations which we now all have of our lives is a problem valuing ourselves. Again, to come back to the American self-help bookstore, if you look at an American self-help bookstore, its shelves will be dominated by two kinds of book. The first kind of book is a little bit like the Anthony Robbins kind. It's going to tell you how to become rich quickly. Lots of titles on, you know, how to make a million in a week, etc. And the other kind of book will be a book on low self-esteem. There are tons and tons of books on low self-esteem. And I think that's not a coincidence. The two are linked. It's when you've tried to make your millions and failed that you'll be heading for the books on low self-esteem. And so it's almost a necessary, you know, these two genres are necessary bedfellows if you have a society that tells its people that, you know, anyone can be anything, and in which that isn't actually practically true, you're going to have a huge self-esteem problem on your hands. So however ugly the phrase low self-esteem is, it's capturing something I think very important about our societies today. Another particularly modern feature which contributes to our anxiety about our status is, this could sound rather paradoxical, is the idea that nowadays our societies are fair, are more or less just. In the olden days, it was very widely accepted that society was completely unfair, that those at the top of society had got there by maybe killing someone, robbing someone, by being in with a particular crowd, that there was a kind of monopoly, an unfair monopoly. And so it was widely accepted that people who got to the top didn't necessarily deserve to be there. It was all based on inheritance, contacts, a closed shop. For about the last 200 years, most politicians on most ends of the political spectrum have fought for a system of much greater fairness, a much greater equality of opportunity. This has had all kinds of wonderful and transforming effects. It does mean that to a great extent, a lot more people can make it to the top, and a lot more people can make it to the top by their own talents. But there is rather a darker side to this idea of a meritocracy and to this idea of a belief in a just society. Because if you really believe that those at the top deserve their success, you have to believe that those at the bottom deserve their failure. There enters into the distribution of rewards a sense of justice, which applies at once to the distribution of favors and punishments. And so I think that can explain a rather harsher attitude in the treatment towards those at the bottom of society that you notice whenever people are most convinced that they live in a fair society. Again, the United States is a particular example of this because Americans generally believe that their societies are fair and do give people equal opportunities. And this can lead to a harsher attitude. I remember a few months ago, I was chatting to some very enlightened, very liberal American friends of mine. And we were having dinner together. And at one point, one of them started making sort of quite sarcastic comments about trailer trash and so, you know, there were trailer trash, etc. And I thought this was, to a British ear, this sounds very surprising. The idea of referring to people who, for whatever reason, have ended up living in temporary accommodation on the edge of a city as trailer trash seems, you know, sounds uncomfortably harsh and very judgmental. It didn't particularly to the friend who was making these comments because I think to them, there was a general belief that American society is fair, and if it's fair, those at the top, you know, deserve to be applauded for their success, and those at the bottom, well, why not mock them and describe them as trailer trash? So I think this is an example in which a belief in a meritocratic society has an odd sting in the tail. Accompanying this has been a decline, I think, in the belief in the idea of luck. In many societies, for long periods, people were not held to be fully responsible responsible for what happened to them. If something very good happened to you, for example, in ancient Rome, one of the things that you would do was maybe to go and thank one of the gods, particularly the goddess of fortune, if things had gone well in politics or in the military or something. Similarly, in Christian societies, if you won a battle or something, it would be God that you would thank. So it was generally believed that human actions did not wholly determine the outcome of human lives. This is really very much drained away as a concept. For example, if I told you that I'd recently started up a multinational company with a huge £1 billion turnover, but I said, well, I've just been lucky, you know, you'd think I was being suspiciously, perhaps arrogantly modest, just as if I said to you that, you know, I've just been sacked, but, you know, I was unlucky. You'd think, well, hang on a minute, what's going on? So we've largely done away with the idea of luck as an explanatory factor in our lives. We very much believe ourselves to be the authors of our own biographies, and this places a huge burden of responsibility. What's happened is that those at the bottom of society tend not only to have certain material consequences of being at the bottom of society, they also have a new feature, which is shame. You only feel ashamed of your condition and embarrassed of your condition if there's some vision that you could have done otherwise. And this is, I think, again, a very modern feature. In the literary world, my own field, there was a sort of corollary to this in the idea of a muse. For centuries, the idea was that if you'd written a book and things had gone well for you, it wasn't just you, it was you plus a muse, who was, you know, a scantily clad, beautiful woman, quite temperamental, who'd come and visit you while you were doing your work. Nowadays, this quite strange idea has disappeared. And with it, the whole ideology of luck. I mean, if I said to my publisher that, unfortunately, you know, I've kind of dried up, I can't finish my contract, I'm really sorry about this, can I, can we negotiate something? And anyway, it's not my fault, it's the muse, she's not with me, they wouldn't buy that. We are very much held responsible for what happens to us, and this hugely increases, I think, the anxiety that we might feel about our status. Before we despair about all of this, I do come in my book to certain solutions, certain responses that people have made down the ages to their status anxiety, and I think we can learn something at least from them. I think at the heart of the book is really the question, how much weight should we give to the opinions of other people? How much should we listen to other people? And I think this is something that we all have to deal with. We all have to come to a view on. And it's a source of anxiety and thought, how we're going to position ourselves in relation to the views of the community we live in. When I was writing the book, I came across a group of people who seemed to me to exemplify the most sensitive relationship that one could possibly have to the views of other people. These are people that I call duelers, people who, for centuries, used to take up their swords, their pistol or a sword, to in response to any insult from the community. It's quite sort of striking that for centuries, you know, if someone called you effeminate, weak, unfaithful, whatever it happened to be, the most logical, normal, sort of honourable response was to try and kill the person who had said this to you. And there were thousands. I mean, in Spain alone, it was estimated that in the 17th century, some 100,000 people died in duels. That is an absolutely extraordinarily high number. Apparently, duels would go on in every town every day. There would be a duel. And again, what we find in the idea of a dueler is an extreme vulnerability to the opinions of other people, that you would rather die than let someone think or let someone sort of get away with calling you an idiot or something. It's much better to try and kill them, or, you know, even if you lose your life in the goal of trying to persuade them otherwise, it's been worth it. I think at the other end of this spectrum of sensitivity to the views of others, there have been two big traditions in Western thought that have argued for something else, and that they've left, I think, a huge imprint on our way of looking at the world. They've taught us that actually there is another way. There is a way of making up your own mind about what is important, rather than just being totally susceptible to the views of whoever you happen to meet in the market square who happens to call you an idiot. And these two traditions are Christianity and philosophy. And at the head of both of these movements has been a martyr figure who went to their death, a
opposed by most members of the community, and yet nevertheless both of these martyr figures maintained faith in the general correctness of their attitude. I'm thinking of Jesus and Socrates, opposed by the majority, standing up against the majority. And this idea of the anti-hero, this idea that there is a difference between truth and opinion, has, I think, left a deep imprint, and one can find this idea bubbling up throughout history. And I think, as I say, it's to a large extent many philosophers who've argued this, that there is a distinction between what people think and what might be true, and that what we really have to be worried about is not what people think, but what the truth is. So if what someone calls you, you know, effeminate or unfaithful, what matters is whether you are effeminate or unfaithful, rather than simply the accusation. So you shouldn't try and kill everyone who says a bad word about you. As a writer, this is good advice, because one could end up having to kill an awful lot of people. It should be, you know, quite tiring and bloody. So this idea that we can, as it were, make up our own minds, that there is an inner audience, an inner conscience, which we can guide our behaviour. One of my favourite philosophers is the German 19th century philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who had held a particularly caustic view of the opinions of other people, and many passages of his works are guided towards telling us basically not to listen to anyone apart from Schopenhauer. He tells us, we will gradually become indifferent to what goes on in the minds of other people when we acquire an adequate knowledge of the superficial and futile nature of their thoughts, of the narrowness of their views, of the paltriness of their sentiments, of the perversity of their opinions, and of the number of their errors. Would a musician feel flattered by the loud applause of his audience if it were known to him that, with the exception of one or two, it consisted entirely of deaf people? So he thinks we're all, you know, the most audiences are deaf, not you, of course, and that, you know, really to place too much weight on the opinions of others is foolish. So that's one response. Another response to anxieties about status has come, I think, from many works of art. And many works of art, if you look at them, are really stories of losses of status in one way or another. If you think particularly of tragedy, the tragic art form is really almost entirely dedicated to telling stories of failure, stories of people who've had high status and then suddenly lost it. And I think they offer a particularly complex and sympathetic, or at least rich, account of how one can fail and yet be understood for being a failure. And I think the attitude of tragic works of art contrasts markedly with the attitude that most people in the community have towards our failure. People who fail tend not to be treated with much sympathy. And I think what we fear often when we fear failure isn't just the material consequences of failure, it's the deeply unsympathetic attitude towards people who will precisely call us losers or whatever in explaining our lives and what's happened to us. So I think a source of relief from that attitude comes in many works of art. When I was making a documentary that I did with this book, we were trying to find an example of people in society who perhaps exemplify this idea of a very harsh attitude towards failure. And we came up with the idea that it's really the tabloid newspapers who, to some extent, have the most extremely unsympathetic attitude towards failure. If you look at tabloid papers, most of the stories in them are of people who've messed up their lives in various ways. They've slept with the wrong person, they've killed someone, they've sunk their companies, whatever it happens to be. They are stories of catastrophic failure, and there's a deep lack of sympathy usually in these stories. What we did with the documentary was we wondered what tabloid newspapers would have done if they'd been given the plot lines of many works of great works of Western tragedy, if, as it were, the plot lines of these works had come into the newsroom. So we went up to see the editors of the Sunday Sport in Manchester, and we gave them the plot of Othello, and we said, well, you know, what kind of headline would you give to this? And they came up with "Love-Crazed Immigrant Kills Senator's Daughter." That would have been their headline for that. We gave them the plot line of Madame Bovary, and they came up with "Shopaholic Adulteress Swallows Arsenic After Credit Fraud." We gave them Sophocles' Oedipus the King. This is my favourite. And they came up with "Sex with Mum Was Blinding." So that's I suppose the tragic approach to things. There have been other responses, I can't go through them all, but there have been other responses to anxieties about status down the ages. One of them has been the suggestion that we start to reflect on our own death a little bit more than sometimes we do. It could sound rather morbid suggestion, but I think it is one of the nice features of thinking about your death, that suddenly certain things seem very, very important and certain other things seem a lot less important. I think the effect of the thought of death is to rearrange our priorities. And very often, I think, we tend to live not for ourselves, but for other people, our teachers, our families, our bosses, our colleagues. And I think the thought of death can make us usefully, productively selfish. It can draw us back towards those things which we perhaps care most about, but maybe don't spend that much time on. And it is a feature, I think, of our lives that we tend to spend quite a lot less time on the things we deeply care about often than on the things which actually we don't care that much about. So, and that's why, you know, for centuries it was considered, you know, if you were an intellectual, the best thing to do, the best way to decorate your study was probably with a skull. So it was, you know, long fashion for putting a skull on your bookshelf. And the reason for this wasn't to make you think, oh, well, all is worthless, you know, we're all going to die. It was to help you to focus on your priority. It was to keep at the forefront of your mind that certain things are important and certain things are not. Thinking about death, in my experience, is a good way of clearing your diary of social engagements. If you're worried that you've got too many friends and you don't know how you're going to fit them all in, to think about death is a good way of clearing the diary. If you reflect on who among your many social acquaintances would make it to your hospital bed, that's going to quickly lead you to sort out your true friends from those who aren't your true friends. And I think another sort of linked point to this, another useful approach to death is to think about the death of other people, to contemplate the death of those people specifically who are making you most envious now. And there's a long tradition in literature and art of the contemplation of ruins, particularly the ruins of ancient Rome or ancient Egypt. Lots and lots of poems in English literature of people who've basically sort of, the basic moral of the story is, you know, in daily life there were kings and slaves, but with death, death is a great equalizer. It's really the idea that we're all going to end up as that most democratic, most egalitarian of substances, dust, and that this should be, in a way, rather a releasing thought. It places the differences between people into a kind of perspective. Connected to this, I think, is the idea that what we need to do is to take a little bit of time away from contact just with other people, and that one of the relaxing and releasing things to do is to get out into nature. Because when we go into nature, I'm talking here of the great deserts, the great mountains, the great oceans of the world, these sort of places have an anxiety-reducing effect, perhaps similar, comparable to the thought of death. And ruins and ruination generally, because really what these great landscapes tend to do is to restore perspective. They as it were, diminish the sense of the importance of the human hierarchy, and they replace it with a much nobler, much greater sense of hierarchy. Let me read you a little bit from my book where I talk about the benefits of going out, heading for the desert or whatever it may be. I say that vast landscapes can have an anxiety-reducing effect similar to ruins, for they are the representatives of infinite space, as ruins are the representatives of infinite time, against which our weak, short-lived bodies can seem no less inconsequential than those of moths or spiders. Whatever differences exist between people, they are as nothing next to the differences between the most powerful humans and the great deserts, high mountains, glaciers, and oceans of the world. There are natural phenomena so large as to make the variations between any two people seem mockingly small. By spending time in vast spaces, a sense of our insignificance in the social hierarchy can be subsumed in a consoling sense of the insignificance of all humans within the cosmos. We can overcome a feeling of unimportance not by making ourselves more important, but by recognizing the relative unimportance of everyone. Our concern with who is a few millimeters taller than us can give way to an awe for things 1,000,000,000 times larger than us, a force which we may be moved to call infinity, eternity, or simply, and perhaps most traditionally, God. So again, the idea there of restoring perspective in some way. I could go on, but time is running short. And really, I'd like to end by saying that at the heart of this book is really a concern with the word success. I'm very concerned with success. I'd like to be very successful. I'm very ambitious. But before we decide what I might mean by that, I think it's important to focus on where we get our ideas of success. What do we understand by success? If I said to you, you know, there's a friend of mine out in the hallway who's a great success, you might have certain ideas about the kind of person I was talking about. But I think part of the theme of the book is really to say, well, let's try and submit that word success to critical scrutiny. Let's ask ourselves what we really mean by success and, you know, where our values are coming from. Is it actually our vision of success that we're living by, or have we sucked it up from somewhere? Are we fully conscious of it? So again, the traditional philosophical project of not just living, but submitting our life to a certain scrutiny. That's the theme of the book. I'm going to stop it there now, but thank you all very much for listening, and we can hopefully have some questions and answers. But thank you.
Well, many thanks to Alain for a thoroughly enjoyable and stimulating talk. Let me just briefly outline the rough plan for the rest of this evening. First of all, I'll be kicking off by asking Alain two or three brief questions, and then we'll be opening up the discussion to take in some questions from the floor. And then Alain has very kindly agreed to sign copies of his book. You can buy copies of his book outside at a 10% discount, so that's a very good deal. So that's roughly the outline. Now, Alain, there's one thing that's particularly interesting me about your work is this link that you're making between meritocracy and status anxiety. The idea that the more meritocratic our values, the more we feel that we're responsible for our own perceived failures and lack of status. And as you say, the corollary to that is this very interesting decline in the fortunes of fortune, if you like, whereas fortune or guardian deities or luck used to have a central role in Western societies. They've now been downgraded to, I don't know, an astrological column in a newspaper. Now, it occurred to me while you were talking that the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre might say that these linked beliefs are a symptom of our technological and irreligious age and are a part of our affliction, our hubristic affliction, that we can control everything. We can control our environment, we can control nature, we can control space, we can control our own destiny. And I wondered how you would respond to that thought.
I think that's absolutely right, that there is a kind of arrogance in the idea that you can tell what someone is worth, just literally sort of by looking at their CV. And of course, this is, I don't know, I mean, if you compare this with the Christian attitude is that people's merit, no one can tell what someone is worth. You can't look at their CV, you can't grade people, there's no top 10 people, etc. You can't do this, and the reason you can't do this is that no one is in any position to fathom someone else's soul. Only God can do this, and he can't even do it right now. He's going to have to wait till the day of judgment. He's then going to be attended to by 1,000 angels. He's going to have a huge pair of scales, and he will do the job. Until then, it is not our prerogative to go around judging people. Now, this could sound rather crazy, the business of scales, etc., but I think it does capture a kind of humility about judging other people, which is so alien to the modern world. You know, we talk all the time about the way that things are performance driven. Let's try and evaluate students, let's try and evaluate people, etc., as though one can do that easily. I'm not saying one way is to say, well, everyone is equal. I think that's to sort of slightly go too far the other way. Obviously, there is not a complete equality of talents, of skills, of goodness. But what there is, I think, is a fundamental mystery about the way that people are put together and about the way in which people's intentions have an effect on their life, etc. So there's a real mystery about people's true worth. And as you say, it is part of the arrogance that comes with sending people to the moon, etc., that we think, well, actually, you know, we should be able to understand this. Let's not leave this to God and the angels.
Thanks. Now, another point I wanted to explore a bit further was your claim that our desire for status is part of our yearning for a certain kind of love, that as well as a desire for erotic and romantic love, we have a desire to be loved by the world. And I can certainly see that if you take love in a broad sense I think you say, in the broad sense of love as a kind of respect and of, is it treating other people with a certain kind of sensitivity and attention? I can see that point. But one thing that occurred to me was, well, maybe it's if we feel that we've failed at gaining the kind of love as it's more normally interpreted from romantic lovers, perhaps from parents and children, from friends, if we feel rather deficient in that form of love, maybe we start craving status more as a kind of compensation. And I'm and that might feed into your point about the conversation you had with the psychologist who said that only 10% of us are emotionally healthy, and we're not, and those aren't the people who care about money and status and books and the rest of it. So I wondered what you thought about this desire for status as compensation.
Yes, I think to some extent it is a kind of compensation. I mean, who would undertake the enormous effort to try and become a so-called success, what we call a success, if they didn't at some level feel precisely the opposite? I mean, there is a very simple, almost simplistic mechanism at work there. I don't think, though, that the answer is just, as it were, personal love. Well, in that case, all we need is a good relationship, then we'll be happy, because I think that is in itself a sort of a kind of myth that actually we can be totally self-sufficient with just the love of one other person. And so, yes, it's true that if you were at the height of passion, the height of a new relationship, you would be unlikely to be that concerned, probably, about how well you're doing at work. But, you know, I think that that is a phase, and it's not a way to build your life. And so I think, in a sense, we are reliant both on a more intimate kind of love and, to some extent, a dignity and respect from other people around us, from the community. We are reliant to some extent on that.
That's great. Now, I'm sure lots of other people have got questions they're longing to ask. Who's going to be brave and start? Now, we have, as a policy, I shall be repeating the question no matter how clearly you say it. That's the general policy. Yes, please.
I think the desire. So, did you want to repeat the question? I think that the desire for love remains there, even for babies and people who have never tasted it, because I think it is absolutely innate. And I think people who've had a kind of traumatized childhood, on the whole, I mean, the pathology, and it does unfortunately end up normally in a sort of semi-pathological behavior. If we're talking extreme abuse, one of the responses is a kind of, in a desperate craving for attention, for respect, for dignity. And you know, if you look into the biographies of most extremely successful business people, extremely successful pop stars, etc., the early years are not pleasant, and it's not a coincidence, I think. To try and promote an ever more meritocratic idea. And that most people would think that's probably a good idea. But I think it's important to recognize that it has a sting in its tail. And weirdly, there is potentially some benefit in a society in which people think that the education system is corrupt. Because actually what that does is to give people, it makes the explanations for who's ended up where slightly more complex. And so though that may be a very bad thing, a corrupt education system, it weirdly teaches people to be a bit more nuanced about how they evaluate others. The dream New Labour world of a meritocracy and a meritocratic education system is also a very harsh world, actually, if one thinks about it. Because what are the consequences of failing in a society in which you've been given every chance, in which things truly are totally equal and equal opportunities?
Thank you.
Sort of the audience, artists, strictly in character, people are only good if they're
I think that in every society there are battles about who is important and for what. And you'll always find in any society subgroups where the dominant values of the age are contested. So there were, you know, for long periods of history, the most important thing to be, particularly if you were a man, or only if you were a man, was to be strong and militarily strong, a good soldier. That was the most important thing, to be a good soldier. Nowadays, you're a good soldier, you're not really anywhere. You're, you know, fine, but it's not, that's not going to buy you high status. We live basically in commercial, mercantile societies where status is earned through being in business, really. That's not to say that there aren't, of course, some subgroups, groups where actually that's the worst thing on earth to be. You find these subgroups sometimes in universities, sometimes in big cities. You get people who basically are standing in opposition to the dominant value system. And to some extent, that's one of the joys of a pluralistic society, that there can be these different visions of who gets status and for what. And we mustn't forget that the status system is actually relatively flexible. A lot of what goes on in politics is really battles between different groups arguing for who should get what status and for what. And I think there are all sorts of puzzles about that. And you know, if you take a lot of the debates, for example, about mothers with children, mothers with young children, at one level, according to the dominant value system, these people are worthless. They don't earn anything if they're not working. They're not earning anything. And so they're completely worthless according to the mainstream value system. And yet you have other people going, well, that's completely crazy. How can that be? What sort of a value system are we living in if people who are looking after children are considered to be absolutely worthless? And then there are debates about, well, what kind of worth does a mother who looking after a child have, etc. So there are constantly tussles. And if you could look at something like feminism as one giant attempt to change the status of one major group in society. And it's, you know, if anyone's feeling hopeless about the situation, it's much easier to change the status system than it is to change the economic system, I think.
Thank you. So you and then you and then you, and that might be, enough. There's so many people, but you're first, please. Yes, please.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that people who are successful, so-called successful, in a society of equal opportunity, or in an ambitious society where people are told they can be anything, sets up that problem that I was talking about, is of envy. And I think we as a society, and all sort of Western meritocratic societies, have terrible problems dealing with success, in the sense that success is the greatest thing. People want success, etc. But then why are they successful and the rest aren't? So is it where there's a terrible... You know, how can you have a society of equals where there's a lot of inequality around? And it's a sort of... You find this played out in the newspapers, for example, where there's literally a sort of sadomasochistic, sort of perverse relationship with success, a certain vision of success, in which, you know, on the one hand, people are constantly goaded to be one kind of thing, to have a certain kind of lifestyle, etc. And then those who've got that then get attacked for whatever, you know, they might have done while having that sort of lifestyle. So, but I think it just reflects the deeper problem of how do you handle inequality. Old societies had a very simple way of handling inequality. They said, God has arranged the hierarchy. God has given the king and queen their place, and God has given you your place, full stop. Nowadays, we don't have that. We have a much more fluid society, and that creates all kinds of terrible anxieties and aggressions in relation both to success and failure.
Thank you. Yes, you please, yes.
If hierarchical societies are leading to status anxiety, is the solution socialism? I don't want to say that all... all societies are hierarchical. So it's just how the hierarchy is arranged, according to what hierarchy you're going to arrange it. The problem with socialism as it's been practiced is that it doesn't eliminate hierarchy. It simply replaces one kind of hierarchy for another. And most people would say that actually the hierarchy of most socialist states ends up even more unfair even more skewed by various small, narrow interest groups than the hierarchies of much more fluid capitalist societies. But that said, there is something in your point about socialism, because I think to some extent how ambitious we are for personal success is to some extent linked on what it's like to be like everyone else, what the community is like. In a community, in a world in which the community is very degraded, where, as it were, it's every man for himself, the urge for individual success is going to be very intense. In a world in which actually being like everyone else, being just ordinary, is going to be accompanied by a relatively comfortable lifestyle, relative material security, relative security of dignity, as, let's say, it's practiced today in modern Norway or Finland, countries routinely held up as examples in this, the urge to be a success and to achieve high status for yourself is going to be lessened. So there is a relationship between what's the community like and what's the quality of the communal environment, and what's the how strong is the urge for individual status?
Thank you very much. Now, I think it was you who was next. Thank you. Sorry, can I?
Yeah. Does it embarrass me that my book is found among self-help books? I guess it depends what one means by self-help, because there's a vision of self-help, which is, you know, books like Anthony Robbins, etc., which tend, in my view, to be not very helpful and, in a sense, quite patronizing. They tend to be very optimistic books. They tend to have a vision of life which I don't particularly share. But I think there is something very important and interesting in self-help books, and that's the idea that, in some way, a book can help you to live. And I think that's a very noble and serious idea. From there on, I then start to part company with most books that are called self-help. But, you know, we're talking about ancient Greek philosophy. A lot of ancient Greek philosophy was basically philosophy of self-help. It was basically the idea that you would go and visit a philosopher in order to try and heal your soul, in order to try and discover how you should live, how you should cope with death, with anxieties, with all sorts of troubles. And, you know, that was considered a very noble and serious idea. And I think it's very sad. I mean, there are lots of reasons for this, but it does seem sad that the idea of a helpful book has come to seem like an almost inherently trashy idea, when, of course, it's one of the sort of great things that books can do for us. They can open our eyes to things, they can explain the world to us, etc. So I'm very happy to be called a self-help writer if I can join a slightly more enlarged vision of self-help writers that might have a bit of space for, I'm not comparing myself, but might have a little bit of space for Socrates and Tolstoy and Proust, etc.
I'm obviously not talking about Alan here, but I've always been very suspicious of a different kind of self-help writer who writes more than one self-help manual, because you think, didn't the first one work? You know, apart from getting him or her a very good bank balance, but that clearly applies to a totally different kind of book. Right, now there was somebody, I think you were next, in the blue shirt there. Thank you, in the front. Yeah.
Do you think
there's a lot of talk about celebrity culture, the fact that we live in a world now where, you know, you don't even have to do anything anymore. You can just become famous by appearing on TV, etc. I think that's sort of superficially appealing as an argument. I would argue that there are, yes, it's very possible to become famous, just as it were, as a celebrity for not doing very much, just appearing on Big Brother, etc. But I think there is a distinction between people who become famous and objects of curiosity and people who become targets of envy and actual role models for us. So, you know, Richard Branson is a target of envy and a role model. Jordan, I think, big generalization, is on the whole a celebrity who we might gawp at and be interested in. But it would be hard, again, maybe there's some people in the audience, but it would be hard to say, actually, I want to model my life on Jordan's life. On the whole, so she's famous, but she's not a role model. It would be hard to feel envious, really, of her life, or of Rebecca Luse's life or something. You know, these are people who are thrown up by the system, but I think, to me, they're more comparable to a sort of Victorian freak show, you know, the bearded lady, etc., than serious targets of envy. And I think, generally, we still live in a bourgeois culture where we very much strongly believe that those who are successful must have deserved their success by hard work. And that's why our heroes really tend to be people like Bill Gates and Richard Branson, people who've worked and have achieved something. These are, I think, still the true celebrities, the true role models of our culture.
Thank you very much. Now, I think we've got, well, certainly one more question, and you've been waiting patiently. Thank you.
Right. It's a big question. I mean, the basic thing is that in a mobile society where, as it were, companies don't tend to last very long, where there's constantly competition from new products, etc., status isn't fixed. I mean, in the olden days, if you were the Duke of X, you'd be the Duke of X from the day of your birth or when your father died or whatever, till the day you died. Nowadays, people who have high status, like Bill Gates, etc., are subject to constant challenges of their status because we live in this very fast-moving society based so much on business. And that explains why there's an awful lot of this status anxiety around, that status is borne out by individual achievement, and individual achievement is constantly under threat, whether you know, you're in a certain kind of business or whether you're in sport or whatever. Who you are today may not be who you are tomorrow, and this is a new situation which has not existed in the past. It may be fairer, but it's also much less calming. You know, you're only as good as your last deal. That's the language of modern business. I think probably we'll have to stop it there, but we could go on for a long time.
I think there was just one more quick. Is it a quick question? Yeah. Okay. Lovely. One quick question there. Thank you.
I mean, I think personal responsibility is something like most things that it's good to have, you know, a balance of. I mean, someone who believes simply that it's just other people who are leading them to do things. They've got no choice at all in their matter. It's just the government that's forcing them. It's society. It's biology, etc. That's clearly an unbalanced view as well. You know, part of the problem is that we're always a mixture of determined and free, and so we are only ever partly responsible. And so, if I'm stressing the business that actually, just to a large extent, we're not as responsible as some people make out, that's not to say that I want to advocate that we are not responsible at all. There's some kind of balance to be found there. But it may be that in societies which keep promoting the idea that, you know, where we end up is our work, is our responsibility, we may be going too far in one direction. But yes, a balance is the only sane but slightly dull answer to this problem.
Oh, that's super. I'm sorry. I know there are many more of you who want to ask questions, and I'm sorry that time doesn't permit. It's just evidence of what a thought-provoking discussion and debate this is. Just to remind you, so what we're going to do now is those of you who wish to have your books signed by Alan can come and have them signed in here. You can still buy the book outside at a 10% discount. And also to remind you that next week at 7:15 we have Alan Hollinghurst, who I guess is talking on the line of beauty. So thank you very much for coming again, and thanks again to Alan Hollinghurst.